Wardle's number. He's all right, loves himself, but you'll be better off with him than Carver. He's a cunt. I can put in a word with Wardle. I'll ring him right now for you if you like. Strike tweaked a tourist leaflet from a wooden display on the wall and copied down Wardle's number in the space beside a picture of the horse guards.
When are you coming over? Anstis asked. Bring Charlotte one night.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'll give you a ring. Got a lot on just now.
After hanging up, Strike sat deep in thought for a while, then called an acquaintance much older than Anstis, whose life path had run in a roughly opposite direction.
"Calling in a favour, mate," said Strike. "Need some information."
"On what?"
"You tell me. I need something I can use for leverage with a copper."
The conversation ran to 25 minutes and involved many pauses, which grew longer and more pregnant, until finally Strike was given an approximate address and two names, which he also copied down beside the horse guards, and a warning, which he did not write down, but took in the spirit in which he knew it was intended. The conversation ended on a friendly note, and Strike, now yawning widely, dialed Wardle's number, which was answered almost immediately by a loud, curt voice.
"Wardle!" "Yeah, hello. My name's Cormoran Strike, and..."
"You what?"
"Cormoran Strike," said Strike, "is my name."
"Oh, yeah," said Wardle. "Anstis just rang. You're the private dick. Anstis said you were interested in talking about Lula Landry."
"Yeah, I am," said Strike again,
suppressing another yawn as he examined the painted panels on the ceiling, bacchanalian revels that became, as he looked, a feast of fairies. Midsummer Night's Dream, a man with a donkey's head.
"But what I really like is the file."
Wardle laughed.
"You didn't save my fucking life, mate."
"Got some information you might be interested in. Thought we could do an exchange."
There was a short pause.
"I take it you don't want to do this exchange over the phone?"
"That's right," said Strike.
"Is there anywhere you'd like to have a pint after our day's work?"
Having jotted down the name of a pub near Scotland Yard, and agreed that a week today, failing any nearer date, would suit him too, Strike rang off. It had not always been thus. A couple of years ago he had been able to command the compliance of witnesses and suspects. He had been like Wardle, a man whose time had more value than most of those with whom he consorted, and who could choose when, where, and how long interviews would be. Like Wardle, he had needed no uniform. He had been constantly cloaked in officialdom and prestige. Now, he was a limping man in a creased shirt, trading on old acquaintances, trying to do deals with policemen who would once have been glad to take his calls.
"Arsehole," said Strike aloud, into his echoing glass.
The third pint had slid down so easily that there was barely an inch left. His mobile rang. Glancing at the screen, he saw his office number. No doubt Robin was trying to tell him that Peter Gillespie was after money. He let her go straight to voicemail, drained his glass, and left. The street was bright and cold, the pavement damp, and the puddles intermittently silver as clouds scudded across the sun. Strike lit another cigarette outside the front door and stood smoking it in the doorway of the Tottenham, watching the workmen as they moved around the pit in the road. Cigarette finished, he ambled off down Oxford Street to kill time until the temporary solution had left, and he could sleep in peace. Chapter 6 Robin had waited 10 minutes to make sure that Strike was not about to come back, before making several delightful telephone calls from her mobile phone. The news of her engagement was received by her friends with either squeals of excitement or envious comments, which gave Robin equal pleasure. At lunchtime, she awarded herself an hour off, bought 3 bridal magazines and a packet of replacement biscuits, which put the petty cash box, a labelled shortbread tin, into her debt to the tune of 42 pence, and returned to the empty office, where she spent a happy 40 minutes examining bouquets and bridal gowns, and tingling all over with excitement. When her self-appointed lunch hour was over, Robin washed and returned Mr. Crowdy's cups and tray and his biscuits. Noting how eagerly he attempted to detain her in conversation on her second appearance, his eyes wandering distractedly from her mouth to her breasts, she resolved to avoid him for the rest of the week. Still, Strike did not return. For want of anything else to do, Robin neatened the contents of her desk drawers, disposing of what she recognised as the accumulated waste of other temporaries. 2 squares of dusty milk chocolate, a bored emery board, and many pieces of paper carrying anonymous telephone numbers and doodles. There was a box of old-fashioned metal acro clips, which she had never come across before, and a considerable number of small, blank, blue notebooks, which, though unmarked, had an air of officialdom. Robin, experienced in the world of offices, had the feeling that they might have been pinched from an institutional store cupboard. The office telephone rang occasionally. Her new boss seemed to be a person of many names. One man asked for Oggy, another for Monkey Boy, while a dry, clipped voice asked that Mr. Strike return Mr. Peter Gillespie's call as soon as possible. On each occasion, Robin contacted Strike's mobile phone and reached only his voicemail. She therefore left verbal messages, wrote down each caller's name and number on a post-it note, took it into Strike's office, and stuck it neatly on his desk. The pneumatic drill rumbled on and on outside. Around 2 o'clock, the ceiling began to creak as the occupant of the flat overhead became more active. Otherwise, Robin might have been alone in the whole building. Gradually, solitude, coupled with the feeling of pure delight that threatened to burst her ribcage every time her eyes fell on the ring on her left hand, emboldened her. She began to clean and tidy the tiny room under her interim control. In spite of its general shabbiness and an overlying grubbiness, Robin soon discovered a firm organisational structure that pleased her own neat and orderly nature. The brown card folders, oddly old-fashioned in these days of neon plastic, lined up on the shelves behind her desk, were arranged in date order, each with a handwritten serial number on the spine. She opened one of them, and saw that the acro clips had been used to secure loose leaves of paper into each file. Much of the material inside was in a deceptive, difficult-to-read hand. Perhaps this was how the police worked. Perhaps Strike was an ex-policeman. Robin discovered the stack of pink death threats to which Strike had alluded in the middle drawer of the filing cabinet, beside a slim sheaf of confidentiality agreements. She took one of these out and read it, a simple form, requesting that the signatory refrain from discussing, outside hours, any of the names or information they might be privy to during their working day. Robin pondered for a moment, then carefully signed and dated one of the documents, carried it through to Strike's inner office, and placed it on his desk, so that he might add his name on the dotted line supplied. Taking this one-sided vow of secrecy gave back to her some of the mystique, even glamour, that she had imagined lay beyond the engraved glass door, before it had flown open and Strike had nearly bowled her down the stairwell. It was after placing the form on Strike's desk that she spotted the kit bag stuffed away in a corner behind the filing cabinet. The edge of his dirty shirt, an alarm clock, and a soap bag peeked from between the open teeth of the bag zip. Robin closed the door between inner and outer offices as though she had accidentally witnessed something embarrassing in private. She added together the dark-haired beauty fleeing the building that morning, Strike's various injuries, and what seemed, in retrospect, to have been a slightly delayed but determined pursuit. In her new and joyful condition of betrothal, Robin was disposed to feel desperately sorry for anyone with a less fortunate love life than her own. If desperate pity could describe the exquisite pleasure she actually felt at the thought of her own comparative paradise. At 5 o'clock, and in the continuing absence of her temporary boss, Robin decided that she was free to go home. She hummed to herself as she filled in her own timesheet, bursting into song as she buttoned up her trench coat. Then she locked the office door, slid the spare key back through the letterbox, and proceeded, with some caution, back down the metal stairs, towards Matthew, and home. Chapter 7 Strike had spent the early afternoon at the University of London Union Building, where, by dint of walking determinedly past reception with a slight scowl on his face, he had gained the showers without being challenged or asked for his student card. He had then eaten a stale ham roll and a bar of chocolate in the cafe. After that, he had wandered, blank-eyed in his tiredness, smoking between the cheap shops he visited to buy, with Bristow's cash, the few necessities he needed now that bed and board were gone. Early evening found him holed up in an Italian restaurant, several large boxes propped up at the back beside the bar, and spinning out his beer until he had half forgotten why he was killing time. It was nearly 8 before he returned to the office. This was the hour when he found London most lovable. The working day over, her pub windows were warm and jewel-like, her streets thrummed with life, and the indefatigable permanence of her aged buildings, softened by the streetlights, became strangely reassuring. "We have seen plenty like you," they seemed to murmur soothingly, as he limped along Oxford Street, carrying a boxed-up camp bed. 7.5 million hearts were beating in close proximity in this heaving old city, and many, after all, would be aching far worse than his. Walking wearily past closing shops, while the heavens turned indigo above him, Strike found solace in vastness and anonymity. It was some feat to force the camp bed up the metal stairwell to the second floor, and by the time he reached the entrance bearing his name, the pain in the end of his right leg was excruciating. He leaned for a moment, bearing all his weight on his left foot, panting against the glass door, watching it mist.
"You fat cunt," he said aloud. "You knackered old dinosaur."
Wiping the sweat off his forehead, he unlocked the door and heaved his various purchases over the threshold. In the inner office, he pushed his desk aside and set up the bed, unrolled the sleeping bag, and filled his cheap kettle at the sink outside the glass door. His dinner was still in a pot noodle, which he had chosen because it reminded him of the fare he used to carry in his ration pack. Some deep-rooted association between quickly heated and rehydrated food and makeshift dwelling places had made him reach automatically for the thing. When the kettle had boiled, he added the water to the tub and ate the rehydrated pasta with a plastic fork he had taken from the Yulu Cafe, sitting in his office chair, looking down into the almost deserted street, the traffic rumbling past in the twilight at the end of the road, and listening to the determined thud of a bass from 2 floors below in the 12-bar cafe. He had slept in worse places. There had been the stone floor of a multi-story car park in Angola, and the bombed-out metal factory where they had erected tents and woken coughing up black soot in the mornings. And worst of all, the dank dormitory of the commune in Norfolk, to which his mother had dragged him and one of his half-sisters when they were 8 and 6, respectively. He remembered the comfortless ease of hospital beds in which he had lain for months, and various squats, also with his mother, and the freezing woods in which he had camped on army exercises. However basic and uninviting the camp bed looked lying under the one naked light bulb, it was luxurious compared with all of them. The act of shopping for what he needed, and of setting up the bare necessities for himself, had lulled Strike back into the familiar soldierly state of doing what needed to be done, without question or complaint. He disposed of the pot noodle tub, turned on the lamp, and sat himself down at the desk where Robin had spent most of the day. As he assembled the raw components of a new file, the hardback folder, the blank paper, and an acro clip, the notebook in which he had recorded Bristow's interview, the pamphlet from the Tottenham, Bristow's card, he noticed the new tidiness of the drawers, the lack of dust on the computer monitor, the absence of empty cups and debris, and a faint smell of pledge. Mildly intrigued, he opened the petty cash tin, and saw there, in Robin's neat, rounded writing, the note that he owed her 42 pence for chocolate biscuits. Strike pulled 40 of the pounds Bristow had given him from his wallet and deposited them in the tin. Then, as an afterthought, counted out 42 pence in coins and laid it on top. Next, with one of the biros Robin had assembled neatly in the top drawer, Strike began to write, fluently and rapidly, beginning with the date. The notes of Bristow's interview he tore out and attached separately to the file. The actions he had taken thus far, including calls to Anstice and to Wardle, were noted, their numbers preserved, but the details of his other friend, the provider of useful names and addresses, were not put on file. Finally, Strike gave his new case a serial number, which he wrote, along with the legend, Sudden Death, Lula Landry, on the spine, before stowing the file in its place at the far right of the shelf. Now, at last, he opened the envelope which, according to Bristow, contained those vital clues that police had missed. The lawyer's handwriting, neat and fluid, sloped backwards in densely written lines. As Bristow had promised, the contents dealt mostly with the actions of a man whom he called the Runner. The Runner was a tall black man, whose face was concealed by a scarf, and who appeared on the footage of a camera on a late-night bus which ran from Islington towards the West End. He had boarded this bus around 50 minutes before Lula Landry died. He was next seen on CCTV footage taken in Mayfair, walking in the direction of Landry's house at 1:39 a.m. He had paused on camera and appeared to consult a piece of paper. Pos an address or directions? Bristow had added helpfully in his notes, before walking out of sight. Footage taken from the same CCTV camera shortly after showed the Runner sprinting back past the camera at 2:12 and out of sight. Second black man also running. Pos look out? Disturbed in car theft? Car alarm went off around the corner at this time, Bristow had written. Finally, there was CCTV footage of a black man closely resembling the Runner walking along a road close to Gray's Inn Square, several miles away, later in the morning of Landry's death. Face still concealed, Bristow had written. Strike paused to rub his eyes, wincing because he had forgotten that one of them was bruised. He was now in that light-headed, twitchy state that signified true exhaustion. With a long, grunting sigh, he considered Bristow's notes, with one hairy fist holding a pen, ready to make his own annotations. Bristow might interpret the law with dispassion and objectivity in the office that had provided him with his smart engraved business card. But the contents of this envelope merely confirmed Strike's view that his client's personal life was dominated by an unjustifiable obsession. Whatever the origin of Bristow's preoccupation with the Runner, whether because he nursed a secret fear of that urban bogeyman, the criminal black male, or for some other, deeper, more personal reason, it was unthinkable that the police had not investigated the Runner and his, possibly lookout, possibly car thief, companion, and certain that they had had good reason for excluding him from suspicion. Yawning widely, Strike turned to the second page of Bristow's notes. At 1:45, Derek Wilson, the security guard on duty at the desk overnight, felt unwell and went into the back bathroom, where he remained for approximately a quarter of an hour. For 15 minutes prior to Lula's death, therefore, the lobby of her building was deserted, and anybody could have entered and exited without being seen. Wilson only came out of the bathroom after Lula fell, when he heard Tansy Bestigui screaming. This window of opportunity tallies exactly with the time the Runner would have reached 18 Kentigern Gardens if he passed the security camera on the junction of Alderbrook and Bellamy Roads at 1:39. "And how," murmured Strike, massaging his forehead, "did he see through the front door to know the guard was in the bog?" "I have spoken to Derek Wilson, who is happy to be interviewed." "And I bet you paid him to do it," Strike thought, noting the security guard's telephone number beneath these concluding words. He laid down the pen with which he had been intending to add his own notes and clipped Bristow's jottings into the file. Then he turned off the desk lamp and limped out to pee in the toilet on the landing. After brushing his teeth over the cracked basin, He locked the glass door, set his alarm clock, and undressed. By the neon glow of the street lamp outside, Strike undid the straps of his prosthetic, easing it from the aching stump, removing the gel liner that had become an inadequate cushion against pain. He laid the false leg beside his recharging mobile phone, manoeuvred himself into his sleeping bag, and lay with his hands behind his head, staring up at the ceiling. Now, as he had feared, the leaden fatigue of the body was not enough to still the misfiring mind. The old infection was active again, tormenting him, dragging at him. What would she be doing now? Yesterday evening, in a parallel universe, he had lived in a beautiful apartment in a most desirable part of London, with a woman who made every man who laid eyes on her treat Strike with a kind of incredulous envy.
"Why don't you just move in with me? Oh, for God's sake, Bluey, doesn't it make sense? Why not?"
He had known from the very first that it was a mistake. They had tried it before, and each time it had been more calamitous than the last.
"We're engaged, for God's sake. Why won't you live with me?"
She had said things that were supposed to be proofs that, in the process of almost losing him forever, she had been as irrevocably changed as he had, with his 1.5 legs.
"I don't need a ring. Don't be ridiculous, Bluey. You need all your money for the new business."
He closed his eyes. There could be no going back from this morning. She had lied once too often, about something too serious. But he went over it all again, like a sum he had long since solved, afraid he had made some elementary mistake. Painstakingly, he added together the constantly shifting dates, the refusal to check with chemist or doctor, the fury with which she had countered any request for clarification, and then the sudden announcement that it was over, with never a shred of proof that it had been real. Along with every other suspicious circumstance, there was his hard-won knowledge of her mythomania, her need to provoke, to taunt, to test.
"Don't you dare fucking investigate me! Don't you dare treat me like some drugged-up squaddy! I'm not a fucking case to be solved! You're supposed to love me, and you won't take my word even on this!"
But the lies she told were woven into the fabric of her being, her life. So that to live with her and love her was to become slowly enmeshed by them, to wrestle her for the truth, to struggle to maintain a foothold on reality. How could it have happened that he, who from his most extreme youth had needed to investigate, to know for sure, to winkle the truth out of the smallest conundrums, could have fallen in love so hard and for so long with a girl who spun lies as easily as other women breathed?
"It's over," he told himself. "It had to happen."
But he had not wanted to tell Anstis, and he could not face telling anyone else. Not yet. There were friends all over London who would welcome him eagerly to their homes, who would throw open their guest rooms and their fridges, eager to condole and to help. The price of all of those comfortable beds and home-cooked meals, however, would be to sit at kitchen tables once the clean pyjamaed children were in bed, and relive the filthy final battle with Charlotte, submitting to the outraged sympathy and pity of his friends' girlfriends and wives. To this, he preferred grim solitude, a pot noodle, and a sleeping bag. He could still feel the missing foot, ripped from his leg 2.5 years before. It was there, under the sleeping bag. He could flex the vanished toes if he wanted to. Exhausted as Strike was, it took a while for him to fall asleep. And when he did, Charlotte wove in and out of every dream, gorgeous, vituperative, and haunted. Part 2. Non ignara mali miseris succarere disco. No stranger to trouble myself, I am learning to care for the unhappy. Virgil, Aeneid, Book 1. Chapter 1 With all the gallons of newsprint and hours of televised talk that had been poured forth on the subject of Lula Landry's death, rarely has the question been asked, why do we care? She was beautiful, of course, and beautiful girls have been helping to shift newspapers ever since Dana Gibson cross-hatched lazy-lidded sirens for the New Yorker. She was black, too, or rather a delicious shade of café au lait, and this, we were constantly told, represented progression within an industry concerned merely with surfaces. I am dubious, could it not be that this season café au lait was the in shade? Have we seen a sudden influx of black women into the industry in Landry's wake? Have our notions of female beauty been revolutionised by her success? Are black Barbies now outselling white? The family and friends of the flesh and blood Landry will be distraught, of course, and have my profound sympathy. We, however, the reading-watching public, have no personal grief to justify our excesses. Young women die every day in tragic, which is to say unnatural, circumstances, in car crashes from overdoses and occasionally because they attempted to starve themselves into conformity with the body shape sported by Landry and her ilk. Do we spare any of these dead girls more than a passing thought as we turn the page and obscure their ordinary faces? Robin paused to take a sip of coffee and clear her throat.
So far, so sanctimonious, muttered Strike.
He was sitting at the end of Robin's desk, pasting photographs into an open folder, numbering each one, and writing a description of the subject of each in an index at the back. Robin continued where she had left off, reading from her computer monitor. Our disproportionate interest, even grief, bears examination. Right up until the moment that Landry took a fatal dive, it is a fair bet that tens of thousands of women would have changed places with her. Sobbing young girls laid flowers beneath the balcony of Landry's £4.5 million penthouse flat after her crushed body was cleared away. Has even one aspiring model been deterred in her pursuit of tabloid fame by the rise and brutal fall of Lula Landry?
Get on with it, said Strike. Her, not you. He added hastily. It's a woman writing, right?
Yes, Melanie Telford, said Robin, scrolling back to the top of the screen to reveal the headshot of a jowly, middle-aged blonde. Do you want me to skip the rest?
No, no, keep going.
Robin cleared her throat once more and continued. The answer, surely, is no. That's the bit about aspiring models being deterred.
Yeah, got that.
Right, well... 100 years after Emmeline Pankhurst, a generation of pubescent females seeks nothing better than to be reduced to the status of a cut-out paper doll, a flat avatar whose fictionalized adventures mask such disturbance and distress that she threw herself from a third-story window. Appearance is all. The designer, Guy Sommet, was quick to inform the press that she jumped wearing one of his dresses, which sold out in the 24 hours after her death. What better advert could there be than that Lula Landry chose to meet her maker in Sommet? No, it is not the young woman whose loss we bemoan, for she was no more real to most of us than the Gibson girls who dripped from Dana's pen. What we mourn is the physical image flickering across a multitude of red tops and celeb mags, an image that sold us clothes and handbags and a notion of celebrity that, in her demise... proved to be empty and transient as a soap bubble. What we actually miss, were we honest enough to admit it, are the entertaining antics of that paper-thin good-time girl whose stripped cartoon existence of drug abuse, riotous living, fancy clothes and dangerous on-off boyfriend we can no longer enjoy. Landry's funeral was covered as lavishly as any celebrity wedding in the tawdry magazines who feed on the famous, and whose publishers will surely mourn her demise longer than most. We were permitted glimpses of various celebrities in tears, but her family were given the tiniest picture of all. They were a surprisingly unphotogenic lot, you see. Yet the account of one mourner genuinely touched me. In response to the inquiry of a man who she may not have realised was a reporter, she revealed that she had met Landry at a treatment facility and that they had become friends. She had taken her place in a rear pew to say farewell and slipped as quietly away again. She has not sold her story, unlike so many others who consorted with Landry in life. It may tell us something touching about the real Lula Landry, that she inspired genuine affection in an ordinary girl. As for the rest of us,
doesn't she give this ordinary girl from the treatment facility a name? Interrupted Strike.
Robin scanned the story silently. No. Strike scratched his imperfectly shaven chin.
Bristow didn't mention any friend from a treatment facility.
Do you think she could be important? Asked Robin eagerly, turning in her swivel chair to look at him.
It could be interesting to talk to someone who knew Landry from therapy instead of nightclubs.
Strike had only asked Robin to look up Landry's connections on the internet because he had nothing else for her to do. She had already telephoned Derek Wilson, the security guard, and arranged a meeting with Strike on Friday morning at the Phoenix Cafe in Brixton. The day's post had comprised two circulars and a final demand. There had been no calls, and she had already organised everything in the office that could be alphabetized, stacked or arranged according to type and colour. Inspired by her Google proficiency of the previous day, therefore, he had set her this fairly pointless task. For the past hour or so, she had been reading out odd snippets and articles about Landry and her associates, while Strike put into order a stack of receipts, telephone bills and photographs relating to his only other current case. "Shall I see whether I can find out more about that girl, then?" asked Robin.
"Yeah," said Strike absently, examining a photograph of a stocky, balding man in a suit and a very ripe-looking redhead in tight jeans.
The besuited man was Mr. Geoffrey Hook. The redhead, however, bore no resemblance to Mrs. Hook, who, prior to Bristow's arrival in his office, had been Strike's only client. Strike stuck the photograph into Mrs. Hook's file and labelled it number 12, while Robin turned back to the computer. For a few moments there was silence, except for the flick of photographs and the tapping of Robin's short nails against the keys. The door into the inner office behind Strike was closed to conceal the camp bed and other signs of habitation, and the air was heavy with the scent of artificial limes due to Strike's liberal use of cheap air freshener before Robin had arrived. Lest she perceive any tinge of sexual interest in his decision to sit at the other end of her desk, he had pretended to notice her engagement ring for the first time before sitting down, then made polite, studiously impersonal conversation about her fiancé for 5 minutes. He learned that he was a newly qualified accountant called Matthew, that it was to live with Matthew that Robin had moved to London from Yorkshire the previous month, and that the temping was a stopgap measure before finding a permanent job. "Do you think she could be in one of these pictures?" Robin asked after a while. "The girl from the treatment centre." She had brought up a screen full of identically sized photographs, each showing one or more people dressed in dark clothes, all heading from left to right, making for the funeral. Crash barriers and the blurred faces of a crowd formed the backdrop to each picture. Most striking of all was the picture of a very tall, pale girl with golden hair drawn back into a ponytail, on whose head was perched a confection of black net and feathers. Strike recognised her, because everyone knew who she was. Kiara Porter, the model with whom Lula had spent much of her last day on Earth, the friend with whom Landry had been photographed for one of the most famous shots of her career. Porter looked beautiful and sombre as she walked towards Lula's funeral service. She seemed to have attended alone, because there was no disembodied hand supporting her thin arm or resting on her long back. Next to Porter's picture was that of a couple captioned film producer Freddie Bastigui and wife Tansy. Bastigui was built like a bull, with short legs, a broad-barreled chest and a thick neck. His hair was grey and brush-cut, his face a crumpled mass of folds, bags and moles, out of which his fleshy nose protruded like a tumour. Nevertheless, he cut an imposing figure in his expensive black overcoat, with his skeletal young wife on his arm. Almost nothing could be discerned of Tansy's true appearance behind the upturned fur of her coat collar and the enormous round sunglasses. Last in this top row of photographs was Guy Sommet, fashion designer. He was a thin black man who was wearing a midnight blue frock coat of exaggerated cut. His face was bowed, and his expression indiscernible, due to the way the light fell on his dark head, though three large diamond earrings in the lobe facing the camera had caught the flashes and glittered like stars. Like Porter, he appeared to have arrived unaccompanied, although a small group of mourners, unworthy of their own legends, had been captured within the frame of his picture. Strike drew his chair nearer to the screen, though still keeping more than an arm's length between himself and Robin. One of the unidentified faces, half severed by the edge of the picture, was John Bristow, recognisable by the short upper lip and the hamsterish teeth. He had his arm around a stricken-looking older woman with white hair. Her face was gaunt and ghastly, the nakedness of her grief touching. Behind this pair was a tall, haughty-looking man, who gave the impression of deploring the surroundings in which he found himself. "I can't see anyone who might be this ordinary girl," said Robin, moving the screen down to scrutinise more pictures of famous and beautiful people looking sad and serious. "Oh, look! Evan Duffield!" He was dressed in a black T-shirt, black jeans, and a military-style black overcoat. His hair, too, was black. His face all sharp planes and hollows. Icy blue eyes stared directly into the camera lens. Though taller than both of them, he looked fragile compared to the companions flanking him. A large man in a suit, and an anxious-looking older woman, whose mouth was open and who was making a gesture as though to clear a path ahead of them. The threesome reminded Strike of parents steering a sick child away from a party. Strike noticed that, in spite of Duffield's air of disorientation and distress, he had made a good job of applying his eyeliner.
"Look at those flowers."
Duffield slid up into the top of the screen and vanished. Robin had paused on the photograph of an enormous wreath in the shape of what Strike took initially to be a heart, before realising it represented two curved angel wings composed of white roses. An inset photograph showed a close-up of the attached card. "Rest in peace, Angel Lula, D.B. Mack," Robin read aloud.
"D.B. Mack, the rapper? So they knew each other, did they?"
"No, I don't think so. But there was that whole thing about him renting a flat in her building. She'd been mentioned in a couple of his songs, hadn't she? The press were all excited about him staying there."
"You're well informed on the subject."
"Oh, you know, just magazines," said Robin vaguely, scrolling back through the funeral photographs.
"What kind of name is D.B.?"
Strike wondered aloud.
"It comes from his initials. It's D.B., really," she enunciated clearly. "His real name's Darryl Brandon MacDonald."
"A rap fan, are you?"
"No," said Robin, still intent on the screen. "I just remember things like that."
She clicked off the images she was perusing and began tapping away on the keyboard again. Strike returned to his photographs. The next showed Mr. Geoffrey Hook kissing his ginger-haired companion, hand palpating one large canvas-covered buttock outside Ealing Broadway tube station.
"Here's a bit of film on YouTube, look," said Robin. "D.B. Mack talking about Lula after she died."
"Let's see it," said Strike,
rolling his chair forwards a couple of feet, and then, on second thoughts, back one. The grainy little video, 3 inches by 4, jerked into life. A large black man wearing some kind of hooded top, with a fist picked out in studs on the chest, sat in a black leather chair, facing an unseen interviewer. His hair was closely shaven, and he wore sunglasses.
"Lula Landry's suicide," said the interviewer, who was English.
"That was fucked up, man. That was fucked up," replied D.B.,
running his hand over his smooth head. His voice was soft, deep and hoarse, with the very faintest trace of a lisp.
"That's what they do to success. They hunt you down, they tear you down. That's what envy does, my friend. The motherfucking press chased her out that window.
Let her rest in peace, I say. She's getting peace right now.
Pretty shocking welcome to London for you, said the interviewer. With her, you know, like falling past your window. D.B. Mack did not answer at once. He sat very still, staring at the interviewer through his opaque lenses. Then he said,
I wasn't there. Or you got someone who says I was?
The interviewer's yelp of nervous, hastily stifled laughter jarred.
God, no, not at all, not...
D.B. turned his head and addressed someone standing off camera.
Think I ought to have brought my lawyers?
The interviewer brayed with sycophantic laughter. D.B. looked back at him, still unsmiling. D.B. Mack, said the breathless interviewer, thank you very much for your time. An outstretched white hand slid forwards onto the screen. D.B. raised his own in a fist. The white hand reconstituted itself, and they bumped knuckles. Somebody off-screen laughed derisively. The video ended.
The motherfucking press chased her out that window, Strike repeated, rolling his chair back into its original position. Interesting point of view.
He felt his mobile phone vibrate in his trouser pocket and drew it out. The sight of Charlotte's name attached to a new text caused a surge of adrenaline through his body, as though he had just sighted a crouching beast of prey.
I will be out on Friday morning between 9 and 12 if you want to collect your things.
What?
He had the impression that Robin had just spoken.
I said there's a horrible piece here about her birth mother.
Okay, read it out.
He slid his mobile back into his pocket. As he bent his large head again over Mrs. Hook's file, his thoughts seemed to reverberate as though a gong had been struck inside his skull. Charlotte was behaving with sinister reasonableness, feigning adult calm. She had taken their endlessly elaborate duel to a new level, never before reached or tested.
Now let's do it like grown-ups.
Perhaps a knife would plunge between his shoulder blades as he walked through the front door of her flat. Perhaps he would walk into the bedroom to discover her corpse, wrists slit, lying in a puddle of congealing blood in front of the fireplace. Robin's voice was like the background drone of a vacuum cleaner. With an effort, he refocused his attention. So the romantic story of her liaison with a young black man to as many tabloid journalists as were prepared to pay. There is nothing romantic, however, about Marlene Higson's story as it is remembered by her old neighbours. She was turning tricks, says Vivian Cranfield, who lived in the flat above Higson's at the time she fell pregnant with Landry. There were men coming in and out of her place every hour of the day and night. She never knew who that baby's father was. It could have been any of them. She never wanted the baby. I can still remember her out in the hall, crying on her own, while her mum was busy with a punter. Tiny little thing in a nappy, hardly walking. Someone must have called social services, and not before time. Best thing that ever happened to that girl, getting adopted. The truth will no doubt shock Landry, who has talked at length in the press about her reunion with her long-lost birth mother. This was written, explained Robin, before Lula died.
Yeah, said Strike, closing the folder abruptly. Do you fancy a walk?
Chapter 2 The cameras looked like malevolent shoeboxes atop their pole, each with a single blank black eye. They pointed in opposite directions, staring the length of Alderbrook Road, which bustled with pedestrians and traffic. Both pavements were crammed with shops, bars and cafes. Double-deckers rumbled up and down bus lanes.
This is where Bristow's runner was caught on film, observed Strike,
turning his back on Alderbrook Road to look up the much quieter Bellamy Road, which led, lined with tall and palatial houses, into the residential heart of Mayfair.
He passed here 12 minutes after she fell. This would be the quickest route from Kentigern Gardens. Night buses run here. Best bet to pick up a taxi. Not that that'd be a smart move if you'd just murdered a woman.
He buried himself again in an extremely battered A to Z. Strike did not seem worried that anyone might mistake him for a tourist. No doubt, thought Robin, it would not matter if they did, given his size. Robin had been asked to do several things in the course of her brief temping career that were outside the terms of a secretarial contract, and had therefore been a little unnerved by Strike's suggestion of a walk. She was pleased, however, to acquit Strike of any flirtatious intent. The long walk to this spot had been conducted in almost total silence, Strike apparently deep in thought, and occasionally consulting his map. Upon their arrival in Alderbrook Road, however, he had said,
"If you spot anything, or you think of anything I haven't, tell me, won't you?"
This was rather thrilling. Robin prided herself on her observational powers. They were one reason she had secretly cherished the childhood ambition that the large man beside her was living. She looked intelligently up and down the street, and tried to visualize what someone might have been up to on a snowy night in sub-zero temperatures at 2 in the morning.
"This way," said Strike, however, before any insights could occur to her,
and they walked off, side by side, along Bellamy Road. It curved gently to the left and continued for some 60 houses, which were almost identical, with their glossy black doors, their short railings either side of clean white steps, and their topiary-filled tubs. Here and there were marble lions and brass plaques, giving names and professional credentials. Chandeliers glinted from upper windows, and one door stood open to reveal a checkerboard floor, oil paintings in gold frames, and a Georgian staircase. As he walked, Strike pondered some of the information that Robin had managed to find on the internet that morning. As Strike had suspected, Bristow had not been honest when he asserted that the police had made no effort to trace the runner and his sidekick. Buried in voluminous and rabid press coverage that survived online were appeals for the men to come forward, but they seemed to have yielded no results. Unlike Bristow, Strike did not find any of this suggestive of police incompetence or of a plausible murder suspect left uninvestigated. The sudden sounding of a car alarm around the time that the two men had fled the area suggested a good reason for their reluctance to talk to the police. Moreover, Strike did not know whether Bristow was familiar with the varying quality of CCTV footage, but he himself had extensive experience of frustrating, blurry, black-and-white images from which it was impossible to glean a true likeness. Strike had also noticed that Bristow had said not a word in person or in his notes about the DNA evidence gathered from inside his sister's flat. He strongly suspected, from the fact that the police had been happy to exclude the runner and his friend from further inquiries, that no trace of foreign DNA had been found there. However, Strike knew that the truly deluded would happily discount such trivialities as DNA evidence, citing contamination or conspiracy. They saw what they wanted to see, blind to inconvenient, implacable truth. But the Google searches of the morning had suggested a possible explanation for Bristow's fixation on the runner. His sister had been researching her biological roots and had managed to trace her birth mother, who sounded, even when allowance was made for press sensationalism, an unsavoury character. Doubtless revelations such as those that Robin had found online would have been unpleasant not just for Landry, but for her whole adoptive family. Was it part of Bristow's instability? For Strike could not pretend to himself that his client gave the impression of a well-balanced man, that he believed Lula, so fortunate in some ways, had tempted fate. That she had stirred up trouble in trying to plumb the secrets of her origins. That she had woken a demon that had reached out of the distant past and killed her. Was that why a black man in her vicinity so disturbed him? Deeper and deeper into the enclave of the wealthy, Strike and Robin walked, until they arrived at the corner of Kentigern Gardens. Like Bellamy Road, it projected an aura of intimidating, self-contained prosperity. The houses here were high Victorian red brick, with stone dressings and heavy pedimented windows on 4 floors, with their own small stone balconies. White marble porticos framed each entrance, and three white steps led from the pavement to more glossy black front doors. Everything was expensively well maintained, clean and regimented. There were only a few cars parked here. A small sign declared that permits were needed for the privilege. No longer set apart by police tape and massing journalists, number 18 had faded back into graceful conformity with its neighbours.
"The balcony she fell from was on the top floor," said Strike. "About 40 feet up, I'd say."
He contemplated a handsome frontage. The balconies on the top three floors, Robin saw, were shallow, with barely standing room between the balustrade and the long windows.
"The thing is," Strike told Robin, while he squinted at the balcony high above them, "pushing someone from that height wouldn't guarantee death."
"Oh, but surely,"
protested Robin, contemplating the awful drop between top balcony and hard road.
"You'd be surprised. I spent a month in a bed next to a Welsh bloke who got blown off a building about that height. Smashed his legs and pelvis. Lot of internal bleeding, but he's still with us."
Robin glanced at Strike, wondering why he had been in bed for a month. But the detective was oblivious, now scowling at the front door.
"Keypad," he muttered,
noting the metal square inset with buttons,
"and a camera over the door. Bristow didn't mention a camera. Could be new."
He stood for a few minutes testing theories against the intimidating red brick face of these fantastically expensive fortresses. Why had Lula Landry chosen to live here in the first place? Sedate, traditional, stuffy, Kentigern Gardens was surely the natural domain of a different kind of rich. Russian and Arab oligarchs, corporate giants splitting their time between town and their country estates, wealthy spinsters slowly decaying amidst their art collections. He found it a strange choice of abode for a girl of 23, who ran, according to every story Robin had read out that morning, with a hip, creative crowd whose celebrated sense of style owed more to the street than the salon.
"It looks very well protected, doesn't it?" said Robin.
"Yeah, it does. And that's without the crowd of paparazzi who were standing guard over it that night."
Strike leaned back against the black railings of number 23, staring at number 18. The windows of Landry's former residence were taller than those on the lower floors, and its balcony, unlike the other two, had not been decorated with topiary shrubs. Strike slipped a packet of cigarettes out of his pocket and offered Robin one. She shook her head, surprised, because she had not seen him smoke in the office. Having lit up and inhaled deeply, he said, with his eyes on the front door,
"Bristow thinks someone got in and out that night, undetected."
Robin, who had already decided that the building was impenetrable, thought that Strike was about to pour scorn on the theory, but she was wrong.
"If they did," said Strike, eyes still on the door, "it was planned and planned well. Nobody could have got past photographers, a keypad, a security guard, and a closed inner door and out again on luck alone. Thing is," he scratched his chin, "that degree of premeditation doesn't fit with such a slapdash murder."
Robin found the choice of adjective callous.
"Pushing someone over a balcony is a spur-of-the-moment thing," said Strike, as though he had felt her inner wince. "Hot blood. Blind temper."
He found Robin's company satisfactory and restful, not only because she was hanging off his every word and had not troubled to break his silences, but because that little sapphire ring on her third finger was like a neat full stop, this far and no further. It suited him perfectly. He was free to show off in a very mild way, which was one of the few pleasures remaining to him. But what if the killer was already inside?
"That's a lot more plausible," said Strike, and Robin felt very pleased with herself. "And if a killer was already in there, we've got the choice between the security guard himself, one or both of the bestiguis, or some unknown person who was hiding in the building without anyone's knowledge. If it was either of the bestiguis or Wilson, There's no getting in and out problem. All they had to do was return to the places they were supposed to be. There was still the risk she could have survived, injured to tell the tale, but a hot-blooded, unpremeditated crime makes a lot more sense if one of them did it. A row and a blind shove.
Strike smoked his cigarette and continued to scrutinise the front of the building, in particular the gap between the windows on the first floor and those on the third. He was thinking primarily about Freddy Bastigui, the film producer. According to what Robin had found on the internet, Bastigui had been in bed asleep when Lula Landry toppled over the balcony two floors above. The fact that it was Bastigui's own wife who had sounded the alarm and insisted that the killer was still upstairs while her husband stood beside her implied that she, at least, did not think him guilty. Nevertheless, Freddy Bastigui had been the man in closest proximity to the dead girl at the time of her death. Laymen, in Strike's experience, were obsessed with motive. Opportunity, top of the professional's list. Unwittingly confirming her civilian status, Robin said,
"But why would someone pick the middle of the night to have an argument with her? Nothing ever came out about her not getting on with her neighbours, did it? And Tansy Bastigui definitely couldn't have done it, could she? Why would she run downstairs and tell the security guard if she'd just pushed Lula over the balcony?"
Strike did not answer directly. He seemed to be following his own train of thought, and after a moment or two replied,
"Bristow's fixated on the quarter of an hour after his sister went inside, after the photographers had left and the security guard had abandoned the desk because he was ill. That meant the lobby became briefly navigable. But how was anyone outside the building supposed to know that Wilson had left his post? The front door is not made of glass."
"Plus," interjected Robin intelligently, "they'd have needed to know the key code to open the front door."
"People get slack. Unless the security people change it regularly, loads of undesirables could have known that code. Let's have a look down here."
They walked in silence right at the end of Kentigern Gardens, where they found a narrow alleyway which ran, at a slightly oblique angle, along the rear of Landry's block of houses. Strike was amused to note that the alley was called Surf's Way. Wide enough to allow a single car to pass, it had plentiful lighting and was devoid of hiding places, with long, high, smooth walls on either side of the cobbled passageway. They came in due course to a pair of large, electrically operated garage doors, with an enormous private sign affixed to the wall beside them, which guarded the entrance to the underground cache of parking spaces for the Kentigern gardeners. When he judged that they were roughly level with the back of number 18, Strike made a leap, caught hold of the top of the wall, and heaved himself up to look into a long row of small, carefully manicured gardens. Between each patch of smooth and well-tended lawn and the house to which it belonged was a shadowy stairwell to basement level. Anyone wishing to climb the rear of the house would, in Strike's opinion, require ladders or a partner to belay him and some sturdy ropes. He let himself slide back down the wall, emitting a stifled grunt of pain as he landed on the prosthetic leg.
"It's nothing," he said,
when Robin made a concerned noise. She had noticed the vestige of a limp and wondered whether he had sprained an ankle. The chafing on the end of the stump was not helped by hobbling off over the cobbles. It was much harder, given the rigid construction of his false ankle, to navigate uneven surfaces. Strike asked himself ruefully whether he had really needed to hoist himself up on the wall at all. Robin might be a pretty girl, but she could not hold a candle to the woman he had just left. Chapter 3.
"And you're sure he's a detective, are you? Because anyone can do that. Anyone can Google people."
Matthew was irritable after a long day, a disgruntled client and an unsatisfactory encounter with his new boss. He did not appreciate what struck him as naive and misplaced admiration for another man on the part of his fiancée.
"He wasn't Googling people," said Robin. "I was the one doing the Googling while he was working on another case."
"Well, I don't like the sound of the setup.
He's sleeping in his office, Robin. Don't you think there's something a bit fishy there?
I told you. I think he's just split up with his partner.
Yeah, I'll bet he has, said Matthew.
Robin dropped his plate down on top of her own and stalked off into the kitchen. She was angry at Matthew and vaguely annoyed with Strike, too. She had enjoyed tracking Lula Landry's acquaintance across cyberspace that day, but seeing it retrospectively through Matthew's eyes, it seemed to her that Strike had given her a pointless, time-filling job.
"Look, I'm not saying anything," Matthew said from the kitchen doorway. "I just think he sounds weird. And what's with the little afternoon walks?"
"It wasn't a little afternoon walk, Matt. We went to see the scene of the... We went to see the place where the client thinks something happened."
"Robin, there's no need to make such a bloody mystery about it," Matthew laughed.
"I've signed a confidentiality agreement," she snapped over her shoulder. "I can't tell you about the case."
"The case?"
He gave another short, scoffing laugh. Robin strode around the tiny kitchen, putting away ingredients, slamming cupboard doors. After a while, watching her figure as she moved around, Matthew came to feel that he might have been unreasonable. He came up behind her as she was scraping the leftovers into the bin, put his arms around her, buried his face in her neck, and cupped and stroked the breast that bore the bruises Strike had accidentally inflicted, and which had irrevocably coloured Matthew's view of the man. He murmured conciliatory phrases into Robin's honey-coloured hair, but she pulled away from him to put the plates into the sink. Robin felt as though her own worth had been impugned. Strike had seemed interested in the things she had found online. Strike expressed gratitude for her efficiency and initiative.
"How many proper interviews have you got next week?" Matthew asked, as she turned on the cold tap.
"Three!"
she shouted over the noise of the gushing water, scrubbing the top plate aggressively. She waited until he had walked away into the sitting room before turning off the tap. There was, she noticed, a fragment of frozen pea caught in the setting of her engagement ring. Chapter 4 Strike arrived at Charlotte's flat at 9:30 on Friday morning. This gave her, he reasoned, half an hour to be well clear of the place before he entered it, assuming that she really was intending to leave, rather than lie in wait for him. The grand and gracious white buildings that lined the wide street, the plane trees, the butcher's shop that might have been stuck in the 1950s, the cafes bustling with the upper middle classes, the sleek restaurants, they had always felt slightly unreal and stagey to Strike. Perhaps he had always known, deep down, that he would not stay, that he did not belong. Until the moment he unlocked the front door, he expected her to be there. Yet as soon as he stepped over the threshold, he knew that the place was empty. The silence had that slack quality that speaks only of the indifference of uninhabited rooms, and his footsteps sounded alien and overloud as he made his way down the hall. Four cardboard boxes stood in the middle of the sitting room, open for him to inspect. Here were his cheap and serviceable belongings, heaped together like jumble sale objects. He lifted a few things up to check the deeper levels, but nothing seemed to have been smashed, ripped, or covered in paint. Other people his age had houses and washing machines, cars and television sets, furniture and gardens and mountain bikes and lawnmowers. He had four boxes of crap and a set of matchless memories. The silent room in which he stood spoke of a confident good taste, with its antique rug and its pale flesh-pink walls, its fine darkwood furniture and its overflowing bookcases. The only change he spotted since Sunday night stood on the glass end table beside the sofa. On Sunday night there had been a picture of himself and Charlotte laughing on the beach at St. Maur's. Now a black-and-white studio portrait of Charlotte's dead father smiled benignly at Strike from the same silver picture frame. Over the mantelpiece hung a portrait of an 18-year-old Charlotte in oils. It showed the face of a Florentine angel in a cloud of long, dark hair. Hers was the kind of family that commissioned painters to immortalize its young, a background utterly alien to Strike, and one he had come to know like a dangerous foreign country. From Charlotte, he had learned that the kind of money he had never known could coexist with unhappiness and savagery. Her family, for all their gracious manners, their suavity and flair, their erudition and occasional flamboyance, was even madder and stranger than his own. That had been a powerful link between them when first he and Charlotte had come together. A strange, stray thought came to him now, as he looked up at that portrait, that this was the reason it had been painted, so that one day its large hazel-green eyes would watch him leave. Had Charlotte known what it would feel like to prowl the empty flat under the eyes of her stunning 18-year-old self? Had she realized that the painting would do her work better than her physical presence? He turned away, striding through the other rooms, but she had left nothing for him to do. Every trace of him, from his tooth floss to his army boots, had been taken and deposited in the boxes. He studied the bedroom with particular attention, and the room looked back at him, with its dark floorboards, white curtains, and delicate dressing table, calm and composed. The bed, like the portrait, seemed a living, breathing presence. "Remember what happened here, and what can never happen again." He carried the four boxes one by one out onto the doorstep, on the last trip, coming face to face with the smirking next-door neighbour who was locking his own front door. He wore rugby shirts with the collars turned up, and always brayed with panting laughter at Charlotte's lightest witticisms.
"Having a clear-out?"
he asked. Strike shut Charlotte's door firmly on him. He slid the door keys off his keyring in front of the hall mirror and laid them carefully on the half-moon table next to the bowl of potpourri. Strike's face in the glass was creviced and dirty-looking, his right eye still puffy, yellow and mauve. A voice from 17 years before came to him in the silence.
"How the fuck did a pew-bedded trog like you ever pull that, Strike?"
And it seemed incredible that he ever had, as he stood there in the hall, he would never see again. One last moment of madness, the space between heartbeats, like the one that had sent him hurtling after her 5 days previously. He would stay here after all, waiting for her to return, then cupping her perfect face in his hands and saying, "Let's try again." But they had already tried again and again and again, and always when the first crashing wave of mutual longing subsided, the ugly wreck of the past lay revealed again, its shadow lying darkly over everything they tried to rebuild. He closed the front door behind him for the last time. The braying neighbour had vanished. Strike lifted the four boxes down the steps onto the pavement and waited to hail a black cab. Chapter 5. Strike had told Robin that he would be late into the office on her last morning. He had given her the spare key and told her to let herself in. She had been very slightly hurt by his casual use of the word last. It told her that however well they had got along, albeit in a guarded and professional way, however much more organized his office was, and how much cleaner the horrible washroom outside the glass door, however much better the bell downstairs looked, without that scrappy piece of paper taped beneath it, but a neatly typed name in the clear plastic holder, it had taken her half an hour and cost her 2 broken nails to prise the cover off. However efficient she had been at taking messages, however intelligently she had discussed the almost certainly non-existent killer of Lula Landry, Strike had been counting down the days until he could get rid of her. That he could not afford a temporary secretary was perfectly obvious. He had only 2 clients. He seemed, as Matthew kept mentioning, as though sleeping in an office was a mark of terrible depravity, to be homeless. Robin saw, of course, that from Strike's point of view, it made no sense to keep her on. But she was not looking forward to Monday. There would be a strange new office. Temporary Solutions had already telephoned through the address. A neat, bright, bustling place, no doubt, full of gossipy women as most of these offices were, all engaged in activities that meant less than nothing to her. Robin might not believe in a murderer. She knew that Strike did not believe either. But the process of proving one non-existent fascinated her. Robin had found the whole week more exciting than she would ever have confessed to Matthew. All of it, even calling Freddie Bastigui's production company Best Films twice a day, and receiving repeated refusals to her requests to be put through to the film producer, had given her a sense of importance she had rarely experienced during her working life. Robin was fascinated by the interior workings of other people's minds. She had been halfway through a psychology degree when an unforeseen incident had finished her university career. 10:30, and Strike had still not returned to the office, but a large woman wearing a nervous smile, an orange coat, and a purple knitted beret had arrived. This was Mrs. Hook, a name familiar to Robin because it was that of Strike's only other client. Robin installed Mrs. Hook on the sagging sofa beside her own desk and fetched her a cup of tea. Acting on Robin's awkward description of the lascivious Mr. Crowdy downstairs, Strike had bought cheap cups and a box of their own tea bags. "I know I'm early," said Mrs. Hook for the third time, taking ineffectual little sips of boiling tea. "I haven't seen you before. Are you new?"
"I'm temporary," said Robin.
"As I expect you've guessed, it's my husband," said Mrs. Hook, not listening. "I suppose you see women like me all the time, don't you? Wanting to know the worst. I dithered for ages and ages. But it's best to know, isn't it? Best to know. I thought Cormoran would be here. Is he out on another case?"
"That's right," said Robin,
who suspected that Strike was actually doing something related to his mysterious personal life. There had been a caginess about him as he had told her he would be late.
"Do you know who his father is?" asked Mrs. Hook.
"No, I don't," said Robin, thinking that they were talking about the poor woman's husband.
"Johnny Rokeby,"
said Mrs. Hook, with a kind of dramatic relish.
"Johnny Roke."
Robin caught her breath, realizing simultaneously that Mrs. Hook meant Strike, and that Strike's massive frame was looming up outside the glass door. She could see that he was carrying something very large.
"Just one moment, Mrs. Hook," she said.
"What?"
asked Strike, peering around the edge of the cardboard box as Robin darted out of the glass door and closed it behind her.
"Mrs. Hook's here," she whispered.
"Oh, for fuck's sake. She's an hour early."
"I know. I thought you might want to organise your office a bit before you take her in there."
Strike eased the cardboard box onto the metal floor.
"I've got to bring these in off the street," he said.
"I'll help,"
offered Robin.
"No, you go and make polite conversation. She's taking a pottery class and thinks her husband's sleeping with his accountant."
Strike limped off down the stairs, leaving the box beside the glass door.
Johnny Rokeby. Could it be true?
"He's on his way, just coming," Robin told Mrs. Hook brightly, resettling herself at her desk.
"Mr. Strike told me you do pottery. I've always wanted to try."
For 5 minutes, Robin barely listened to the exploits of the pottery class and the sweetly understanding young man who taught them. Then the glass door opened, and Strike entered, unencumbered by boxes, and smiling politely at Mrs. Hook, who jumped up to greet him.
"Oh, Cormoran, your eye," she said. "Has somebody punched you?"
"No," said Strike. "If you'll give me a moment, Mrs. Hook, I'll get out your file."
"I know I'm early, Cormoran, and I'm awfully sorry. I couldn't sleep at all last night." "Let me take your cup, Mrs. Hook," said Robin.
And she successfully distracted the client from glimpsing, in the seconds it took Strike to slip through the inner door, the camp bed, the sleeping bag, and the kettle. A few minutes later, Strike re-emerged on a waft of artificial limes, and Mrs. Hook vanished, with a terrified look at Robin, into his office. The door closed behind them. Robin sat down at her desk again. She had already opened the morning's post. She swung side to side on her swivel chair. Then she moved to the computer and casually brought up Wikipedia. Then, with a disengaged air, as though she was unaware of what her fingers were up to, she typed in the two names. Rokeby Strike. The entry appeared at once, headed by a black-and-white photograph of an instantly recognizable man, famous for 4 decades. He had a narrow harlequin's face and wild eyes, which were easy to caricature, the left one slightly off-kilter due to a weak divergent squint. His mouth was wide open, sweat pouring down his face, hair flying as he bellowed into a microphone. Jonathan Leonard, Johnny Rokeby, born August 1, 1948, is the lead singer of 70s rock band The Deadbeats, member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, multi-Grammy Award winner. Strike looked nothing like him. The only slight resemblance was in the inequality of the eyes, which in Strike was, after all, a transient condition. Down the entry, Robin scrolled. Multi-platinum album Hold It Back in 1975, a record-breaking tour of America was interrupted by a drugs bust in L.A., and the arrest of new guitarist David Carr, with whom... until she reached personal life. Rokeby has been married 3 times. To art school girlfriend Shirley Mullins, 1969 to 1973, with whom he has 1 daughter, Mamie. To model, actress and human rights activist Carla Astolfi, 1975 to 1979, with whom he has 2 daughters, television presenter Gabriella Rokeby and jewellery designer Daniela Rokeby, and, 1981 to present, to film producer Jenny Graham, with whom he has 2 sons, Edward and Al. Rokeby also has a daughter, Prudence Donlevy, from his relationship with the actress Lindsay Fanthorpe, and a son, Cormoran, with 1970s supergroupie Leader Strike. A piercing scream rose in the inner office behind Robin. She jumped to her feet, her chair skittering away from her on its wheels. The scream became louder and shriller. Robin ran across the office to pull open the inner door. Mrs. Hook, divested of orange coat and purple beret, and wearing what looked like a flowery pottery smock over jeans, had thrown herself on Strike's chest and was punching it, all the while making a noise like a boiling kettle. On and on the one-note scream went, until it seemed that she must draw breath or suffocate. "Mrs. Hook!" cried Robin, and she seized the woman's flabby upper arms from behind, attempting to relieve Strike of the responsibility of fending her off. Mrs. Hook, however, was much more powerful than she looked. Though she paused to breathe, she continued to punch Strike until, having no choice, he caught both her wrists and held them in mid-air. At this, Mrs. Hook twisted free of his loose grip and flung herself on Robin instead, howling like a dog. Patting the sobbing woman on the back, Robin manoeuvred her by minuscule increments back into the outer office.
"It's all right, Mrs. Hook, it's all right," she said soothingly, lowering her into the sofa. "Let me get you a cup of tea. It's all right."
"I'm very sorry, Mrs. Hook," said Strike, formally, from the doorway into his office. "It's never easy to get news like this."
I thought it was Valerie,"
whimpered Mrs. Hook, her dishevelled head in her hands, rocking backwards and forwards on the groaning sofa.
"I thought it was Valerie, not my own sister." "I'll get tea," whispered Robin, appalled.
She was almost out of the door with the kettle when she remembered that she had left Johnny Rokeby's life story up on the computer monitor. It would look too odd to dart back to switch it off in the middle of this crisis, so she hurried out of the room, hoping that Strike would be too busy with Mrs. Hook to notice. It took a further 40 minutes for Mrs. Hook to drink her 2nd cup of tea and sob her way through half the toilet roll Robin had liberated from the bathroom on the landing. At last she left, clutching the folder full of incriminating photographs and the index detailing the time and place of their creation, her breast heaving